If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on Friday to move through a number of news topics that we didn't get to otherwise in our talk shows. Well, not even halfway through the year, already over 20,000 gun violence deaths in 2021 in this country. That according to gunviolencearchive.org. Tuesday morning, three members of a Cedar Rapids family died in a shooting. A 20-year-old college student has been charged with killing his parents and younger sister in their family home. Ryan Foley of the Associated Press joins us now. He's been covering this grim story. Ryan, welcome to the program. Tell us how these deaths were reported on Tuesday morning. It was through a 911 call, wasn't it?
Yes. University of Iowa student Alex Jackson called the police around 8:23 Tuesday morning, saying that a masked intruder had broken into his home and shot his father and shot him. And police arrived within minutes, and they found Jackson's parents and younger sister all killed from gunshot wounds in their Cedar Rapids home.
And Alex, the 20-year-old, he had a gunshot wound to his foot. And tell us more about the relevant facts that led police to believe that Alex Jackson should be charged with murder here.
Yes, Alex Jackson said that he struggled with this masked man, that he woke up to the sound of gunfire in the middle of the night, had struggled with him over this rifle that had been left out, and was shot in the foot. But investigators say that they believe all of that was made up to excuse the fact that he had actually killed his parents and his younger sister, Sabrina. They say they found, you know, no sign of forced entry or burglary at the home, that they interviewed neighbors. No one saw any such masked man, and that the physical evidence at the scene pointed to a triple homicide case.
Mm-hmm. Any sign of a motive here?
Not really. They're suggesting that perhaps he had been arguing with his father recently about whether he needed to get a job over the summer or move out of the home. But it's puzzling to a lot of people because, you know, this was a very good family, good neighbors. Alex Jackson had no prior criminal record. He was a high achieving student. He was in the band at Cedar Rapids Kennedy High School. He was an Eagle Scout, in 2017. He worked to, fix up a historic home. And so people are trying to figure out that if he did do this, what led up to it? What caused this change in him?
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the victims of this tragedy. We had 61-year-old Jan Jackson, 68-year-old Melissa Jackson, his wife, and the 19-year-old daughter, Sabrina Jackson.
Yeah, the family had lived in Cedar Rapids for the last 10 years. They had previously lived in Oregon. And Sabrina Jackson, like her older brother, was a high-achieving student at Kennedy High School. She was also attending the University of Iowa. She was involved in Democratic politics. She had introduced presidential candidate Andrew Yang when he visited Cedar Rapids to discuss global warming with high school students back in 2019. And she had, you know, a lot of friends in high school and college who, many of them came out to a vigil for her and her family at Kennedy on Tuesday night. And I know less about the parents at this point, but I know Melissa Jackson had worked as a photographer in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, neighbors say that it was just very nice folks.
Yeah. Such a tragedy. And as you noted in your reporting, quoting the Cedar Rapids Police Department spokesman, this case is the first known triple homicide in Cedar Rapids since 1982, only the second since at least 1959, according to that Cedar Rapids source you have there. Ryan, briefly before we go, please update us on a shooting that took place last December at a political rally Wednesday. News on that, right?
Yes, Michael McKinney, 26 years old, he pleaded guilty this week to intimidation with a dangerous weapon and willful injury for a shooting that injured a 15-year-old girl in Des Moines. This shooting came during a tense confrontation between a group of African-American teenagers and a much larger group of supporters of President Donald Trump who were protesting the outcome of the presidential election at this rally in downtown Des Moines.
Okay. Ryan Foley, thanks for joining us. Associated Press reporter. Ryan, take care.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Wednesday of this week, Governor Reynolds signed a wide-ranging tax bill into law that changes how mental health services will be funded in our state. Let's talk with Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of NAMI Iowa. That's the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Peggy, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I understand you and many others were with the governor for this bill signing ceremony. It's a sweeping law, including these tax cut priorities that legislative Republicans have worked on for years. But for our discussion, let's focus, of course, on the mental health care aspect. I want to ask you about the significance of shifting funding from Iowa's mental health care system from property taxes to the state's general fund. How big and significant is this realignment?
It is big and significant.
How?
It is a big deal. Iowa is the last state in the nation to be funding mental health and disability services through property tax. And it was time for that to change. The state needed to make an investment to allow for a more equitable and sustainable form of funding, as well as more strategic and collaborative planning and implementation of services across the state.
Mm-hmm. Describe a little bit how the property tax model up to now, funding model, didn't work well. What are some specific examples of why that didn't work well?
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem was we've shifted from 99 counties just all doing their own thing to 14 regions, which is certainly an improvement. But the problem is these regions are still governed by boards that are made up of county supervisors. And each county is allowed to have their own levy for the mental health property tax from anywhere from zero to the maximum, which is $47.28. And there are regions that within the region, you have one county at zero and one county at the max. And then they're everywhere in between. And as you might imagine, that causes problems, because their counties are mad at each other because they feel like one is not holding up their end of the bargain. They get focused on what each individual levy is, and if each county is taking care of their own citizens versus really acting and thinking as a region. Mm-hmm. And then even beyond that, the regions being able to truly collaborate and work together on a statewide basis is difficult when so much of the focus is still at the county level with what is being levied.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there are problems with the levy too, because there are two different limits on it.
Mm-hmm.
Growing urban counties like Polk have been limited for they've been stuck at the same level for 7 years, and it's based on 1996 spending. So the urban growing counties have had a really hard time dealing with that, So there's all kinds of problems with it, and we're hopeful that by shifting how it's funded, the regions are still in the picture. We hope that they can focus on truly working together to implement, making sure that all the services that have been mandated for Iowans are actually there for people.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, so for the individuals seeking mental health care, what difference will this make? I mean, also talk about the comparison there between the old and the new. Can you give us an example of someone receiving poor mental health care because of that county property tax system and what you hope it will change to?
Well, there used to be counties that really didn't do anything. and then there were counties like Polk and Johnson that did a lot. So really it was the luck of the draw, you know, what county. And then those urban counties, of course, tended to take care of a lot of people from outside the county. But it fell on the property taxpayers of that county to, the burden was on them.
Mm-hmm.
So Broadlawns, for example, in Polk County, takes care of a lot of people from outside of Polk County, but it's county funded. And the same with University of Iowa hospitals. Now that's, of course, a state system, but there are other examples of that. So obviously you're going to tend to have services in urban counties because that's where providers are. That's where more people are. But we also need to make sure that things like access centers and intensive residential homes for adults and another big area of need is children's crisis services, that those are available no matter where you live. And you shouldn't have to live in a large urban county, and you also shouldn't have to drive 2 or 3 hours to access a service. And when you're in a crisis, especially, you need to have it available to you in a reasonable amount of time. And right now, we're still experiencing long waits in hospital emergency rooms for people who are in a psychiatric crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about days.
Okay, and you think
when law enforcement
that will disappear? That will be fixed.
They're often required to stay with them. So obviously that is a problem. And the reason for that is because we don't have the places for them to go. So unless they're okay to go back home, or unless there is a bed in an acute inpatient center, which not everyone needs, and not all hospitals have that either, they're kind of out of luck.
Yeah.
We need to develop those services robustly across the state.
Peggy, let me ask you this. The new law, of course, gives the state more power with this shift from property taxes to the state's general fund in the funding of mental health care in the state. More power to the state, but they have to put the funding forward. Do you have assurance? Are you confident that legislators will, year after year, keep up with adequate funding?
I'm pretty confident. And the reason for that is because I believe we've reached a tipping point in Iowa with mental health. I think legislators have heard loud and clear that people want to have this funded. I think that there were enough people over enough years who suffered greatly from the neglect of the system, frankly, the failure to keep up with the times. We closed institutions, but we didn't develop the community-based services that were needed to take their place. And so, unfortunately, a lot of people have ended up incarcerated, just untreated. 90% of people who are chronically homeless have an underlying mental health treatment, mental health condition. And so I really believe that legislators have heard loud and clear that this is a priority. An Iowa poll a few years back showed it was the number one priority of Iowans above education, clean water, public safety, everything else, it was mental health care. So I feel pretty confident that they've gotten that message and that we will be able to keep the pressure on to make sure that this is a standing appropriation. So it really actually would be hard for them to eliminate it, very hard to eliminate it and hard to reduce it.
Okay, Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of NAMI Iowa, commenting on the new law signed this week by the governor, moving funding support from local property taxes to the state. Peggy, thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope you're doing well on this Friday, the 18th of June. Before we go to a break, a quick COVID update from Michaela Ram, reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hi again, Michaela.
Hey, Ben.
Let's start off, if we could, by having you share some of the latest COVID numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we've seen in weeks past, hospitalizations and new deaths continue to remain steady. This past week, there were 68 individuals hospitalized. And this past week, we also reported 14 new deaths, so bringing the total to about 6,110 individuals who have died since the pandemic began. So we're still seeing those increase despite the vaccine, but you know, the vaccine has really done a lot to help us address that. At this point, we have about 1.4 million Iowans who are eligible for the vaccine, fully vaccinated. So that accounts for about 44% of the state's population.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we still have a ways to go before we, before the desired herd, so-called herd immunity. Tell us a little bit more about what the vaccination numbers look like when we sort of have a map of Iowa in front of us and look at county by county, region by region. What comes out when you do that, Michaela?
Yeah, absolutely. So taking a look at the full state vaccination rate, you know, the rate per county looks wildly different. You know, Johnson County right now is the highest percent of its population fully vaccinated, about 55-56% based on the last numbers that we pulled at the Gazette. But, you know, there are counties in Iowa that are even below 30%. You know, for example, I'm taking a look at the map. Davis County right now is about 27%. Lyon County up in the northwest corner of Iowa is about 28%. And those numbers haven't really moved much in recent weeks.
Mm-hmm. With the people you talk to, I wonder how we move people to get vaccinations who haven't yet. Of course, that a lot of that has to do with understanding why they are not getting a vaccination. What are the various reasons there? And are these reasons things in people's minds that can be changed or simple awareness raised?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, talking with public health officials across the state, you know, sometimes they say that individuals just haven't made getting the vaccine a priority. You know, maybe they haven't been affected by the virus or maybe they haven't seen that impact on their lives. So, you know, they're not necessarily lining up outside the door to get a vaccine. However, public health officials say the model that vaccines are being distributed right now, you know, in your doctor's office, when you go in for a physical or a routine checkup, your doctor will say, hey, well, we're here, you know, you are eligible for the vaccine and we have shots available. Would you like one? Public health officials say that that's probably going to go a long way in getting people to take the vaccine. You know, their doctor is an individual that they trust. And, you know, when they say they should get the vaccine, likely they will take it. Unfortunately, though, there is a subset of the population that is just against the vaccine, and we likely will never see them take that inoculation. You know, in those counties that I talked to that are seeing high rates of that, they say that misinformation is really a big factor about that. Or, you know, maybe they don't believe that the virus is actually as bad as people kind of make it out to be. So I think public health officials are really struggling with that. And they say, because of that, some areas of the state likely won't reach that herd immunity that we need.
Mm-hmm. What types of misinformation have you come across? Of course, there's the ubiquitous that you are being injected with some kind of microchip for tracking purposes or control purposes, which is, of course, has no basis whatsoever. But other misinformation that is common out there, Michaela?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the public health officials saying with young people, you know, there are concerns or, you know, that misinformation that these vaccines cause infertility. So that is a big factor, I think, for the younger demographic. But unfortunately, you know, like you said, with the microchips or, you know, this false information that it causes infertility, this is really spreading pretty rapidly on social media. And unfortunately, it's very difficult for these local public health officials to combat. You know, their reach on Facebook or Twitter is only so far.
Mm-hmm. News of the Test Iowa program this week. Remind us what Test Iowa is in this pandemic and what's happened there new.
Yeah, absolutely. So Test Iowa was a $26 million free coronavirus testing program that Governor Kim Reynolds announced and implemented back in April 2020. She signed a no bid contract with a Utah-based tech company to provide free coronavirus testing. At this point, we have about 17 sites across the state. So individuals can sign up online, go get a test. And that was a really good, you know, throughout the pandemic, a really good way for us to understand how the virus is spreading and where it was ending up. Well, this past week, the state said because demand for these COVID tests are down so much that they've decided to end the program. So officially July 16th, the last Test Iowa site will close in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm wondering, when we talk about testing, do we know how many tests have been revealing the variants here, which are of great concern to people around the world? And we have seen them pop up in the United States, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the State Hygienic Lab is really the entity that is keeping an eye out on the variants. So, you know, the State Hygienic Lab receives COVID tests and verifies them, and they've been able to detect these variants in Iowa through just routine testing of the tests that do come through. So we have been able to find, for example, the Delta variant made its way into the state recently. So I imagine that the State Hygienic Lab will continue to keep an eye for those variants, especially as they become more prevalent globally.
Mm-hmm. Michaela, I understand you have some new work coming out this weekend in the Gazette. Can you give us a preview of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So like our previous conversation talking about this goal to reach herd immunity, you know, taking a look at this county map and seeing where the vaccination rates in Iowa are the lowest, you know, I reached out to those counties and really tried to talk to them about, you know, what does this mean for your county to not reach herd immunity? And, you know, I got insight from them basically how they're preparing to deal with the coronavirus for the foreseeable future. And, you know, we talked a lot about how we still have measles and whooping cough pop up in communities because immunization rates in Iowa have been dropping in recent years, unfortunately. So talk to them about how public health officials are hoping to cope with that for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Look for that new work from Michaela Ram, reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Michaela, thank you very much for the update.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Coming up in just a few minutes after the break, I'll talk with political scientist Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. We'll have her thoughts on how Iowa's gubernatorial and congressional races are shaping up for 2022. Also, a longtime Iowa organizer, a Black Iowan, shares her thoughts on Juneteenth, our newest federal holiday. That's when we return with this News Buzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Iowa is known far and wide for corn and soybeans, but those of us who live here know that Iowa is so much more. I'm Charity Nebbe. From agriculture to high culture, each day on Talk of Iowa, I talk to farmers, artists, authors, musicians, scientists, athletes, and others who make Iowa what it is. Talk of Iowa, weekday mornings at 10 on Iowa Public Radio.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few moments, a longtime Iowa organizer shares her thoughts on Juneteenth, our newest federal holiday. But first, let's look at developments this week that are shaping Iowa's gubernatorial and congressional races for next year's midterm elections. Those are just over 500 days away. Donna Hoffman joins us, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's have a few points here. I'll ask you a few questions as we sort of have you set the scene for 2022. Tuesday night, the Democratic State Representative Ross Smith kicked off his campaign for governor in his hometown of Waterloo, promising to help build a state that celebrates diversity, welcomes Iowans as they are. Smith, the first major candidate to announce a campaign challenging our current governor, Republican Kim Reynolds. She's widely expected to seek re-election in 2022. How do you see this race and this first entry of a major candidate?
Well, if you're the first entry, you know, as a major candidate, as you mentioned, then, you know, you have the platform, you have the stage. And certainly I think Ross Smith captured that with his announcement. He came out with a biographical video, which, you know, major candidates typically will do, that introduces themselves, kind of introduces the theme of the campaign. But one of the things we should note here about 2022 in Iowa is that we're still kind of waiting on two key pieces of things to be decided. And the first one of those is whether Senator Grassley will run for re-election. His seat is up in 2022. Mm-hmm. He has said he will not decide until the fall. And why that matters potentially maybe even here is that you may have people do different things depending on whether Grassley decides to retire or whether he decides to run for re-election. So that is why you have people saying, I'm thinking about it, people not necessarily making firm decisions yet, because that's a key variable there. The other one related to 2022, not so much for the governor's race, but for other races, is also what the four congressional districts in Iowa will look like as well, because census data has been delayed, and we don't know exactly what those boundaries are going to look like. And also, again, we have various people who may be eyeing a congressional seat, may be eyeing a Senate seat, may be eyeing a run for the governor. And so there's a lot of moving pieces here that still very much are not decided.
Back to the, well, we have the Senate race, a statewide race, and the governor's race, statewide race. Democrats, Donna, have not done well in this state, in statewide races in recent years. If I'm right, I think Tom Harkin, the last statewide Democrat to hold a statewide office, the last Democrat, Senator Harkin. So it's definitely an uphill battle for the Democrats, isn't it?
Well, it is. But we should note here that there are some statewide races that Democrats have won. Tom Miller, for example, state attorney general. Rob Sand is currently the state auditor. He's a Democrat. Mm-hmm. It's the top tier races that likely people are defaulting to in terms of Senate governor, for example. So Democrats can certainly be competitive in these races. The question, you know, becomes if you are a politician and you are strategic, which race will you go into? Do you have progressive ambition? That is, do you want to move up in terms of kind of the hierarchy of political office? And is it a good time to jump in? Senator Grassley, being a very well-known incumbent, you know, some Democrats that might run if that seat were open will not run if Senator Grassley runs for re-election. And the same is a little bit true in the governor's race as well, because Kim Reynolds, of course, will be an incumbent. But yet we know that the Democrats are going to have to run people, and there will be prominent Democrats who will get into that race. And again, we see Ross Smith announcing that he's going to jump into that, what's, you know, likely a competitive primary early, so that he can start building his name recognition, start putting together his campaign organization, locking down supporters and donors and all the things that one needs to do to be competitive in first a primary, then a general election.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at Iowa's first district, however that may look currently, a sort of northeast corner of the state. Tuesday, State Senator Liz Mathis, she's a Democrat from Hiawatha, said she's seriously considering a bid next year for the congressional seat currently held there by U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. It was Hinson, a Republican, who ousted the Democrat Abby Finkenauer in the 2020 election. I guess Liz Mathis will announce at the end of next month whether she will pursue that. We have, these are Liz Mathis, a former evening anchor for both KWWL and KCRG, and also Hinson, a former news anchor on TV. So comment on this possible race.
Right. So we have two, you know, potential familiar faces to people in those viewing areas, which largely, you know, kind of currently overlaps with District 1, both of them, you know, in the Lynn the area that's currently part of District 1. And given the, you know, nature of the population in the state, you know, Linn County is one of the biggest counties, and, you know, likely will be in, you know, my guess is a northeast kind of district there, but both of them in those areas. Now, we should add here that it is not unusual for incumbents and challengers both to move once redistricting takes place. This is true of both state legislators mm-hmm. as well as members of our congressional delegation as well. In the past, when redistricting has happened and lines have been redrawn, sometimes homes change so that they live in the new district. So that's a possibility, you know, potentially here too, but I think unlikely because it is Linn County in that sense. But you certainly have two women both served in state legislature, as you mentioned, prominent faces on local television stations. So they have some element of name recognition as well. And so certainly if Liz Mathis runs, there, you know, could likely be a competitive primary there as well. She may have an advantage in scaring off some other people who might be thinking about that race. You know, but again, given the boundary lines there are still a little bit fluid, you're going to have some people hanging back at this point, even while we have someone like Liz Mathis say she's thinking about it.
Right. Regardless of who the nominee is, Liz Mathis or another facing Ashley Hinson, I think, again, an uphill battle because this is a midterm for a Democratic president. This is typically when the party in the White House loses seats in Congress, right?
That's correct. So, you know, the first midterm that a president's party has, typically, but not always, loses seats. However, you have a countervailing trend here is that Ashley Hinson is a freshman, and she is going to be running for her first reelection, and that is when one is most endangered, typically, barring some kind of scandal. So we saw Abby Finkenauer was defeated in that first reelection campaign, for example. And furthermore, she defeated Rod Blum, who actually had run once successfully for re-election. And so the more time you're in those seats, typically, the more credibility, the more things you have to claim credit for that you have, the better known you are to your constituents. And so, especially in Iowa, we tend to like our incumbents, generally speaking. You know, Hinson has that challenge of being a freshman. And so that could be a countervailing trend in terms of the overall kind of big picture of will the Democrats be able to hold their majority in the House. And certainly this district will be important because it is seen as potentially being one that Democrats could retake, and it is certainly one Republicans want to hold if they are to capture the majority.
Okay, so good to have your analysis. Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Until next time, Donna, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
It's Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, President Biden, Vice President Harris signed a bill into law to make June 19th a federal holiday commemorating the emancipation of enslaved black Americans. The bill passed overwhelmingly in the U.S. House on Wednesday after clearing the Senate unanimously. Our new federal holiday marks the day in 1865 when a Union general informed a group of enslaved people in Texas that they had been made free 2 years earlier by President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation during the Civil War. Let's talk with Latasha Deloach. She is founder and a longtime organizer of Iowa City Juneteenth. Welcome to the program, Latasha.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Juneteenth has been celebrated for years by states and local communities across the country. Why is it important that it be a federal holiday?
I think it really reaches back and lets us think about what was really happening when our nation became its own nation, and that we had people who were not even considered people at that time. So I think it's important because it brings us up to the place where all of us became people in our mm-hmm. country, and that we can celebrate that our black sisters and brothers were free. They were no longer have to be enslaved. And so I think it's important that we understand the distinction. I think both 4th of July and Juneteenth are important for different reasons. And Juneteenth allows us to get our humanity back. And it's important that that is something that's recognized. And this has been gone ignored for over 150 years. So I think it's due. It's definitely due.
All right. You're a Black American, a Black Iowan. How would you recommend celebrating Juneteenth, regardless of your skin color?
You know, I really think that, you know, I think we should commemorate more than necessarily celebrate. I do love put together lots of the Juneteenth celebrations, but over time we realized it was really more of a commemoration, right? There is a little bit of solemn moment there of recognizing that millions of people have died, millions of people were treated terribly in this country, and also that after the enslavement had ended, that for many, many years afterwards and almost up to current day, there still has been remnants of that time. And so it's a time to reflect on that. It's a time to keep yourself up to date with literature and articles and different things that are going on in reference to the Black community. But yes, it's okay to celebrate. So make sure you show up to those Juneteenth events. One thing I noticed is sometimes here in Iowa, we don't see as many white Iowans come out to Juneteenth events. So these events, for some reason, is registering to folks that this is a Black activity. And the reality is almost as a part of truth and reconciliation, as a thing we've been talking about for a while, that they should be some of the main people there, right? This is our opportunity to come together and recognize this time happened, but also work together to continue to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Quickly before we go, I feel I have to ask you about this, Latasha. How do you view the overwhelming support in the U.S. Congress for Juneteenth as a federal holiday in light of many states, like Iowa, banning the teaching of critical race theory?
It is a conundrum, for sure. I really am, as a Black Iowan, I am finding myself a little confused about what time period I'm in sometimes here in Iowa, just given that we seem to be going in the opposite direction in history. And I believe that, you know, I appreciate the federal level and the work that they're doing to try to continue to move us forward. I'm really hoping that our Iowan legislators will look at some of the different things that are happening, and that there can be some opportunity for them to look on the things that they're continuing to do around critical race theory, and realize that this is a theory, and it's a theory, right? So it's like, this is how this could look, this is how this could be, and that it's okay to give our children and our students an opportunity to think critically about race. And I think that is a little bit disruptive in how we educate our children. We're there to teach them to be critical thinkers, mm-hmm. yet we are telling them that they can't think critically about race.
Okay. Latasha Deloach, thank you very much. Founder and longtime organizer of Iowa City Juneteenth. Enjoy your first federal Juneteenth tomorrow. Latasha, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for allowing me on the show today.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before we groove into the weekend with CeCe Mitchell, let's touch base with Dennis Reese. Dennis, the weekend weather I'm interested in, especially because we did an entire show yesterday on this horrible statewide Midwest drought. I've been hearing you talk about thunderstorms possibly in some parts of the state. Any of that popping up yet?
Well, we had really nothing so far today of any significance. It looks like Sunday, Ben, maybe pretty good chance for some showers. So we're going to look forward to that. And we are, of course, hoping for rain. All the regions pretty much need rain except for the extreme southeast. But the big news is, we probably won't get a lot of rain. It will be cooler. Unbelievable, but it will be finally cooler on Monday. Look at these highs, Ben. Monday here in Iowa, mid-60s north, mid-70s south. Tuesday in Iowa, low to mid-70s. So there is some good news there with the cool weather.
Wow. Those are highs. We were lucky to get into those as lows overnight here this last week, weren't we?
Well, just about 24 hours ago, well, it was probably more like 2 p.m. yesterday, something like that. I looked at the weather map in Clarion, North Central Iowa, Webster City at North Central Iowa area was sitting at 102 degrees for an air temperature. Now it is, it's not quite as hot today. We won't see some record highs today, but we'll see highs quite warm this afternoon in the 90s, low 90s today, and then tomorrow Saturday, low 80s northeast, low 90s central and south. So a couple of warm days still ahead.
Okay, Dennis, thank you very much for that weekend weather update up into early next week when we'll get those lower temperatures as daytime highs. Dennis Reese, thanks. Well, I want to remind you, Monday on this program, we'll continue our series of conversations with Iowa veterans who served in Afghanistan. On Monday, I'll talk with retired Iowa Army National Guard Officer Chad Cook about his deployment in Afghanistan back in 2004 and 2005. Of course, our series of conversations with Iowa veterans who served in Afghanistan pegged to the complete withdrawal of U.S. troops going on right now, due to be completed by September 11th. Let's groove into the weekend with CeCe Mitchell, IPR's Studio One Tracks host. Hi, CeCe.
Hey there, Ben.
Let's have you introduce us to a couple of tunes you've been playing there on Iowa Public Radio Studio One. What do you have for us first?
Absolutely. So our first song today comes from this new album by Slater Kinney. It's called Path of Wellness. And Slater Kinney is one of those bands that I know between me and Mark and Tony, it's all one of our favorite bands. They're a duo of ladies, and they've always been an all-female band or since the 90s. They've got this really cool sound, and they've got a really punchy bite to their lyrics and their vocals, and they're really fun to listen to. They've got their new album out. They're actually, Slater Kinney, the band, is our classic artist of the week for the upcoming week on Studio One Tracks. I'll be talking to Mark and Tony about that during the Saturday afternoon version of Tracks tomorrow afternoon. We always talk about our upcoming featured release and classic artists. So Slater Kinney is our classic artist for the upcoming week because they just came out with this new album, Path of Wellness. So every night this upcoming week, with the exception of tomorrow night because of the special Juneteenth broadcast, you'll be hearing an older Slater Kinney song, anticipating this new album of theirs, which will also be playing on Tracks as well. So to introduce you to this new album by Slater Kinney called Path of Wellness, this track is called Favorite Neighbor.
Time for one, CeCe Mitchell, we have time for one more tune to groove us into the weekend. What do you have?
Sure thing. It's off the new record, Butterfly 3000 by, you'll love this band title, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. So they're another one of our favorites here at Studio One. They make really great modern psychedelic music, and their name is really fun to say on the air. They've got quite a few albums out, but this one's a little bit different because it's more electronic than their usual crunchy sound. So I think more people will actually, it's a bit more palatable to the new King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard fan. So this track is Dreams off their new album, Butterfly 3000.
Thank you.
I love it, CC. But good luck trying to understand those lyrics. I did pick out Dreams because you said it before. They really bury those in that electronic music. Nice, though. Mm-hmm. King. I want to have some fun saying their name, too. See if I say it right. King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard's Dreams?
Yes, perfect.
Well, you have yourself a wonderful weekend, CC. Thanks for grooving us into the weekend.
Thanks, Ben. Happy Juneteenth.
Happy Juneteenth to you. River to River, produced today by Zachary Oren Smith. Our other producers, Matt Alvarez and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.